We have a tendency as leaders to get focused on the analytic side. And what happens, Alan, is it suppresses that emotional intelligence side, that empathic side, and we physiologically don't even know it. So we come in, we're checking boxes. That's why SMART goals have been found not to be as effective as people thought, because you're so into this task side of the brain that we lose sight of the emotional intelligence side. And I will tell you, if there's one message for the leaders listening to this today, you need to work on your EI. It needs lots of work. Mine needs lots of work, and I'm working on it every single day, and I'm aware of it.
Dr. Gary Johnson, you currently serve as Vice President of Sales at UniGroup, the largest residential moving company in the United States, and you're based in St. Charles, Missouri. You work directly with senior leaders and sales teams as on aligning leadership behavior, culture, performance in an environment where trust and consistency matter at scale. Alongside your corporate role, you serve on the board of directors for Lewis and Clark, where you collaborate with HR leaders on a range of matters. You hold two master's degrees and a doctor of business administration with a focus on leadership, trust, and organizational effectiveness. And you're working on a new book about leadership authenticity. You're also the host of the Legendary Leadership Lessons podcast, where you interview CEOs, executives, and thought leaders. Gary, welcome to this conversation. I'm looking forward to our chat.
Alan, thank you so much. I'm really looking forward to it as well. We had an opportunity offline to meet each other, and the topic of leadership authenticity is near and dear to my heart, so I can't wait to get into it.
Likewise, I'm all for that whole authenticity thing. So let's just dive in straight away. Let's get straight to the point. The authenticity gap. What is it? Where is it? Why is it? And how can leaders close it in practical ways?
It's a great question. So, Alan, one of the first things I did, just to give you just some quick background on my why. So, I didn't grow up with a lot of mentorship. So, my parents did the best they could with what they had, but I didn't get a lot of focus, didn't get a lot of mentorship, and it really didn't change much when I got into the business world. I had this hunger to grow and to learn, and yet I just didn't really feel like I found any leaders that I either worked with or for that were willing to invest in me. And after 20 plus years of kind of floundering around trying to figure that out, at 55 years old, I said, you know what? I'm going to go back and get my doctorate in leadership. I want to do that for two reasons. One, I want to learn as much as I can about what great leadership looks like so that I can apply those principles. But secondly, I went and became a board certified coach, executive coach, with that process so that I could bring back those ideals and those values to other leaders. Because, Alan, there's a major gap out there in the world of leadership. Real quick, give you some background. So when I did my doctorate, I did a dissertation. My dissertation was on the role of leadership authenticity and its impact on workplace trust. And I had a chance to study. My doctorate was applied, which means I went into a real company and found a problem, and then we tried to solve it. And so what we found out in the research was that there was a gap. So leadership authenticity is really made up of four core elements. It's very similar to servant leadership. It's similar to transformational leadership, but it has four key elements. One, leadership authenticity has self-awareness, which is an emotional intelligence component, right? People that can really regulate their emotions, can feel and understand others, they know how to navigate that. So that's the first element. The second element of leadership authenticity is what's called relational transparency. I have the ability as a leader to connect. You know, Stephen Covey talks a lot about that. Nito Quibain talk a lot about that. It's this ability to inspire, to connect with those around you, to be vulnerable in an appropriate way. The third element of leadership authenticity is what's called balance processing, Alan. And what that really says is that I'm willing to seek out input before making important decisions, and I'm willing to seek out input as it relates to my deeply held beliefs. I'm okay having those challenged. And then the fourth element of leadership authenticity is leading with an internal moral compass. So that's what leadership authenticity is. And it all sounds great. And if you sat in a room with 1,000 leaders and said, what do you think about these principles? Do you think they matter? Every hand would go up. The challenge is that when we go out and ask employees, do you think your leader's authentic? Two major studies recently said no. Both Gallup and Gartner did studies asking that question, and less than 30% of employees characterized their leaders as authentic. And Alan, here's the real problem with that. You know, you and I are in an age where we used to remember, you know, the Zig Ziglars of the world and others talking about what was called soft skills. These are these things that we would consider to be, they matter, but we really couldn't quantify them. That's not the case anymore. Every single component of leadership authenticity has been correlated either through Richard Boyatzis' work or Daniel Goleman's work in direct impact to the bottom line, to employee engagement, to increase the retention, to increase revenue per employee. So why do we have the gap? That's the challenge, right? It would seem to think that that would go away, and it hasn't.
Yeah, you read my mind. I was going to ask you why.
Why do you think?
Well, I don't know. Is it that people feel that they've got to present a certain image? There's this image that of leadership that, you know, I've got to portray, and
right.
I might not be that person, so therefore I've got to act it out. There's also the whole macho thing about leadership.
Yeah,
I think we've also come from a military model of leadership after the Second World War, where leadership models were based on military leaders. And it's that whole command and control, you know, you shut up, you do what you're told, you know, you're at work to do a job, so if you leave your personal problems at home. There's that to it. But what's your sense of it?
Yeah, it's such a great, it's a perplexity. It really is. When I sit down and think about it, and Alan, I see it everywhere. It doesn't matter the size of the organization, small, medium, large. Leaders get into roles, especially when they get into the C-suite, where I feel like they think they made it. And so I'm here, I climbed the mountain, I did what I needed to do to get to this level, and they stopped trying to get better. That's one of the first things that I see. You know, when you think about self-awareness and why it matters so much, I think the first element of self-awareness, I posted on LinkedIn about this recently, is I first have to decide I have to get better, right? So the first thing I have to say is I'm a leader, I'm at a high level in an organization, I have this unbelievable responsibility put on me to help these people each and every day. And command and control, Alan, it's dead. It doesn't work anymore. Mm-hmm. It's trust and inspire. And people don't, the only thing you're ever going to get from command and control is you might get some compliance. You'll never get commitment. Mm-hmm. And in order for us as leaders to be able to do that, I think the first thing we have to admit, we have to look in the mirror and we have to say, in order for this organization to grow at the level it needs to grow, to be able to handle change, to be able to have people come in every single day that want to give their best, I got to start with me, right? I have to be willing, Alan, in that role to get better. And I have to demonstrate that I have a growth mindset. And I see so often people get into that role and they don't mirror the culture that they're trying to create. And we as leaders, we're the ones that shape that. We allow certain behaviors in the organization. We disallow others. But we as leaders have to first and foremost understand that even though I've made it, that's just where it begins. I have to continue to work to get better. So the first thing that I see, Alan, when it comes to why is there a challenge, I think leaders aren't waking up every single day and understanding that they don't lead strategies. They lead people. Mm-hmm. And strategy's great, but as Peter Drucker told us, culture will eat strategy for breakfast. And so we must first understand, as a senior leader in an organization, that I must first look at myself. I don't know if you've ever read the book, Alan, It's Your Ship. It's written by Captain Michael Abrashoff. It's in my top five leadership books. I'll tell you a quick story on it. Abrashoff was captain of the USS Benfold, a destroyer in the United States Naval Fleet. And when he took over this destroyer, and there's roughly 300 sailors on a destroyer, they're very sophisticated pieces of equipment, these ships. When he took it over and came aboard, the sailors were booing the other captain off the ship. And so he's thinking to myself, man, what did I get myself into here, right? That particular destroyer was at the bottom of every single test that the Navy gives for combat readiness, every one of them. And when Captain Abrashoff came aboard that ship, he demonstrated everything we talked about earlier as it relates to authenticity. The name of the book says it all. It's your ship. So he got to know every, he knew all 300 sailors' names, every one of them, got to know their significant other's names. And he had a process of asking them every single day, what do you think our challenge is on this ship? And how do we get better? How do we improve our combat readiness? Quick example from the book. One of his sailors came up to him one time when he was asking this, and they had this tendency to have to paint the sides of the ship regularly because of the salt in the ocean. And it would corrode the nuts and bolts on the ship. And so the rust stains would come down the ship. And so they'd spend all this time kind of painting. And one of the sailors came up to Abrashoff and said, you know, Captain, if we had stainless steel nuts and bolts on the side of these panels, we wouldn't have to paint them all the time, and we could use that time to test. He said, great idea. So he went to one of his senior officers and said, next time we're in port, take the Navy company card, credit card, and go buy some steel, stainless steel nuts and bolts, because I already checked the Navy supply. We don't have any. So he didn't ask permission. He sent him off to Home Depot. They bought some of these stainless steel nuts and bolts. He informed his leaders, but he didn't ask permission. They changed them out, and they took all that time that they used to use to paint to do combat readiness. That's one example of what happened, Alan, in 9 months. Within 9 months, that ship went from the least successful in combat readiness to number one in the Pacific Fleet. Number one, using the same sailors that booed the other captain off the ship. What does that say? I think it says everything about the impact a single leader in an organization can have if they demonstrate the principles of leadership authenticity. So I think the biggest challenge we have is we put these leaders in roles and then we don't hold them accountable. We don't, the board doesn't hold them accountable. The shareholders don't hold them accountable to getting past one quarter's worth of success and building a culture that really makes a difference.
Now, you talk about emotional intelligence. If you were to, as it were, put your hands behind your head and sit back and kind of look at the landscape, have we got a lot of emotional intelligence at executive level? Is it there?
No.
Not.
No. I'll
Okay.
tell you a quick story on this. So
Yeah.
there's a theory called the introspection illusion, okay? And what this says, Alan, is if you and I went into a room of senior leaders and we asked them to complete a self-assessment on emotional intelligence, what they'll have a tendency to do is they will measure themselves based on their intention, and they measure other people based on their behavior. So when they do their self-assessment, they will base it on their intention, and they think their intentions are honorable and good, and they probably are. But they'll score themselves that way. So they'll take this emotional intelligence self-assessment and go, man, I'm killing it. I mean, my score is great. Look how good I'm doing. The challenge is 80 to 90% of them will say that they're EI is very high, but then when we go out and do the peer reviews, that score comes in at 10 or 15%. So the biggest challenge that we have is that a lot of us in leadership feel that we don't have a problem. And the reality is that we do. So emotional intelligence is it's arguably, Alan, the most important skill we have as a leader today.
So there we
Absolutely.
go. So
Yeah.
why is it that people are getting into executive positions without emotional intelligence?
You know, I wish I could answer. If I had the answer to that, I would be a gazillionaire, because I see it every day, and I wish I could explain it. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know if it's what you said earlier, Alan. I don't know if it's that leaders get into a certain level of authority and they feel like they have to have all the answers, and so that they can't demonstrate vulnerability, they can't look themselves in the mirror. I mean, there's imposter syndrome and some other things that are out there that can help them evaluate that maybe I'm not as strong as I need to be, but they're not actively seeking out growth. I mean, example, Leo Battari is a very good friend of mine. He runs an organization in the United States that's based on peer advisory. He's read a lot, written a lot of books on it. And peer advisory is when one CEO would get into a group of the other CEOs and use that group as kind of their personal board of directors. And it's had such impact on these leaders and their ability to grow. Here's the challenge of how great that is, of the millions of leaders that we have that are in leadership, there might be 60, 70, 80,000 of them that are in some group like that in the whole world. And so I wish I could answer why they don't do it. Why don't they go get an, here's another, why don't you go get an executive coach? Why don't you go get somebody, Alan, that tells you you don't have clothes on, right? The emperor doesn't have, why don't you go get somebody that'll tell you what you need to hear instead of what you, that people think you want to hear? Because if you don't do that, when you get into that C-suite, people are afraid to tell you the truth. And we need to be in a position as leaders, Alan, where we step back and say, I have to develop my emotional intelligence skill and I can't do it by myself. And unfortunately, most leaders just don't do much to work on it, in my opinion. They don't put in the work.
Are you saying then that leaders are not really in touch with the truth about themselves? That there's that not so much of a self-knowledge?
I think that's what the research demonstrates. I think it's not only what I'm saying. I think the research supports it. I mean, when I had Richard Boyatzis on my podcast not too long ago, he's been cited 4,000 times, Alan. Other than Daniel Goleman, Richard Boyatzis has been cited more than anyone when it comes to emotional intelligence and to what he calls intentional change theory and these things that we need to do. And the research is absolutely clear on the impact of emotional intelligence. There was a study by Ellen Van Oosten and some others in 2019 where they studied some financial advisors and demonstrated an absolute correlation between their level of EI and the bottom line. It's there. I mean, we have it. You can sit with a leader, Alan, and say, here's what the numbers say. And they'll nod and they'll say, yep, that sounds good. And they're off to their spreadsheet and they're off to their next meeting and they're so task-oriented. A quick point on this, Alan. We have two super neural networks at work in our brain all the time. One is analytic and the other is empathic. When I did my research, when I did my study, I studied a multi-billion dollar company that was led by engineers. Engineers are historically wired to be analytic, right? They think about things logically.
Yep.
You can say the same things about accountants. You can say, if you look at the average MBA program out there, go see how many of them have a program on emotional intelligence. You're going to find not very many. Not many. They did at Case Western for a period of time where Richard was at, and they even got away from it there. But the point is this, the research is absolutely clear that the impact here is high. Yet we have these two super neural networks at work all the time. We have a tendency as leaders to get focused on the analytics side. And what happens, Alan, is it suppresses that emotional intelligence side, that empathic side, and we physiologically don't even know it. So we come in, we're checking boxes. That's why SMART goals have been found not to be as effective as people thought, because you're so into this task side of the brain that we lose sight of the emotional intelligence side. And I will tell you, if there's one message for the leaders listening to this today, you need to work on your EI. It needs lots of work. Mine needs lots of work, and I'm working on it every single day, and I'm aware of it. So you got to work at it.
Okay. And is there a generational component to it? Is it is there hope for the younger generations coming through that they're more inclined to have emotional maturity, or not necessarily?
You know, it's an interesting question. I don't have the research to support whether they are more willing to be empathic than other generations, although I will say that they tend to be more focused on and passionate about having something that they stand for, right? When you look at these younger generations, they want to work for a company that they believe in the mission, and the mission's beyond just, you know, the bottom line. So I think there is hope. I think the younger generation is in touch more with their feelings. And I think that's part of this, that once you understand that those feelings matter and you can start to work on them, I think they have the propensity to be better leaders because they want that shared vision and they want to believe in that passion of what that organization stands for. So I think maybe, but I don't have the research directly to say I can tell you that without a fact, but that's just my general observation.
You know, Gary, one of the things that I say this very much with my tongue in my cheek, I say that people have got what I call an authenticity ohmometer, where they can intuitively sense when a person is being themselves. Now, what does that say about the level of trust in organizations then?
It says that if you fake it, you're going to be in really big trouble, because what we do have this ability to sense it out. It's actually one of the things, Alan, when I'm training salespeople, that I'm talking about is you must first connect before you provide content, and in a true connection, not looking at the fish on their wall and saying, "Hey, you must be a great, love fisherman. I like to drink water. Look, we have something in common." That they read through that so fast, and actually the guard goes up. So I think as humans, if we try to fake authenticity, it'll actually backfire on us, right? It'll backfire. So we first have to decide, I want to be authentic. I need to work on my authenticity. And I have to demonstrate some real vulnerability to my team so that they can see me as a human. Once they see that, the trust level, oxytocin goes up, which is our trust hormone, and you can start to really have a difference with them. But if they'll smell it on you so fast if it's fake, that you're in danger if you try that. Right?
Yeah, you're right. Gary, I want to throw a couple of rapid fire questions at you,
Yeah.
get you off the top of the head. You might have even answered some of them already. Now, what do leaders get wrong about authenticity?
What do people get wrong about it?
Yes.
I think a lot of people don't really understand it. I think when they hear authenticity, they think, "Oh, I'm just going to be me. I'm going to be the real me." And that's really not what authenticity is. It's, part of the challenge we have in this world, Alan, is everybody's become me-centric. It's all about me, 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 me. It's not. If you want to be a great connector, it's about the other person. So great authenticity is not about me, it's about you. And I think that's where they get it wrong.
Okay, good point. Most common excuse leaders use to avoid being authentic?
Too busy. I don't have
Oh.
time.
Oh.
Hey, Gary, I would love to do that, but my capacity bucket's full. And I say, well, you know what? Every single human being has the exact same capacity bucket. It's what we decide to put in it. So it doesn't sound like you have a capacity problem. It sounds like you have a priority problem.
Authenticity, is it born or built?
Say it again.
Authenticity, born or built?
100% built. It can absolutely be built. Emotional intelligence is built. There are some people that have a better tendency towards it or understand it a little better or might be more in tune with that part of their brain, but it absolutely is built.
Vulnerability, we spoke about it earlier on. Do you see it as a strength or a liability?
A 100% superpower. If
And
we demonstrate appropriate vulnerability, appropriate, it can do huge things to create connection between you and your team. It absolutely matters.
okay, last one. One daily habit that strengthens authentic leadership. What could people do?
Going to bed or waking up reading something related to it. So whether that's a self-help book, whether that's a new article that's come out about it, whether that's a new podcast like this one that you can listen to either before you go to bed or when you wake up. Those are the best times to do it. Sinks into the subconscious better.
Okay. Now, Gary, one of the things that I do in wrapping up my chat, I always ask the person I'm speaking to this question. I've learned that experts have things on their hearts that they want to share, they feel people need to hear and know. What is it that you feel people need to know? What's on your heart?
That one of the greatest responsibilities that we've been given when we're put into leadership is that we have been given an opportunity to have 40 hours of impact on someone each and every week. Bob Chapman, who's become a friend of mine, wrote the book Everybody Matters. If you haven't read it, you need to. He runs a multi-billion dollar company. He's considered one of the top CEOs in the world. And what he demonstrates in that book, what he talks about is the last thing he wants is one of his employees to go home and kick the cat and be upset and treat their pa family poorly because they were treated poorly at work. We have an awesome responsibility, and it's up to us as leaders to take it serious.
Dr. Gary Johnson, thank you for sharing your wisdom, your insight, and your time with us. Much appreciated.
Alan, so much my pleasure. I can't wait for this to come out. Thank you for taking the time, and thanks until we speak again.